Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Russ Hughes, founder of Pro Tools Expert and various other audio expert sites. But first of all, turnabout is fair play, but usually it doesn't happen for an artist. Usually it's the record label that gets the upper hand. But we've just seen something this last week that really turned that on its ear. UMG got stung by Frank Ocean. Now, whether you like Frank Ocean's music or not, this is an interesting story because what ended up happening was Frank got the upper hand of Universal Music, the biggest, baddest record label on the planet right now. So what happened was everybody was waiting for his album, which is about 5 years in the making. And there was a lot of promo that UMG put out in order to kind of build up to this. What ended up happening was he released a visual album called Endless on Apple Music as a video stream. And then the very next day, turned around and released an audio-only album called Blonde. Now, the whole thing was that Blonde was on his own label. The reason why he did that was he had fulfilled his contractual obligation. So what ended up happening was Universal wound up with an album that was only video. That's it. Only a bunch of videos. And they didn't have the rights to the audio portion. It turns out that Frank parlayed an advance from Apple Music to pay off all the money that he owned Universal. And then, unbeknownst to Universal, started to create the real album. Not what he was playing for people, not what he was showing anybody, but the real album. Now, usually there's something in the contract that says, after the last record, you have to wait X amount of time before you can release another record on another label. And apparently that wasn't the case in this agreement, which you'd have to wonder, how would a Universal attorney let that go by? But anyway, it's very interesting because UMG got caught, and usually that doesn't happen to a record label. So hats off to Frank Ocean. Whether you like his music or not doesn't matter. He actually got one over on a major record label. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com, as well as my music industry and music industry production blogs. Just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, where you can also read excerpts from my books. Next thing I want to talk about is the passing of Rudy Van Gelder. And for those of you who don't know Rudy Van Gelder, he was probably the pioneer engineer. Everybody always thinks of Bruce Swedeen as kind of the godfather of modern engineering. Rudy Van Gelder may have superseded him. As a matter of fact, I know he did. He was 91 years old when he died. And Rudy was responsible for all of the big jazz recordings of the 50s and 60s and even afterwards, 70s and 80s. All the stuff from Blue Note and CTI, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Donald Byrd, Thelonious Monk, Sonny Rollins, Wayne Shorter. You can go on and on and on and on. But he was a trendsetter in many ways that most people don't realize. The first thing was, he was one of the first do-it-yourself guys. He never worked for a record label. He never had a mentor. He learned all by himself. Not only that, he was the first guy to have his own home studio. Most of those fantastic recordings were done in his parents' living room. And eventually, he developed his own from-the-ground-up studio in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. They became very famous, and there's a lot of hits that came out of that as well. Hundreds and hundreds of hits. But the fact of the matter is, he was the first guy to do that. He was also the first guy to understand about microphones and how important they are. And he had the second Neumann U47 in the United States and quickly learned that Neumanns were the thing for him to get his sound. So he specialized in using Neumann microphones, and he promoted Neumann in the United States before anybody knew anything about them. Pretty interesting. Rudy Van Gelder was also someone who would never tell anybody his methods and techniques. A lot of people asked, a lot of people wanted to know. I always wanted to get him to interview for the Mixing Engineer's Handbook and never could. And he never told anybody how he did things. And only in the last 5 or 6 years did he have an assistant. He always did everything by himself. It was completely do-it-yourself. So all these great techniques that he used, and he made wonderful recordings, none of the techniques are documented. And the only thing we have are a few pictures of all these various artists in the studio. But even then, Rudy would actually change things. He would change microphone positions, so no one ever knew for sure what he was actually doing and what he wasn't. He was also very fastidious about his gear, always wearing white gloves when handling his microphones, never letting any of the clients move his microphones. He was a one-of-a-kind guy. He was way ahead of his time. If you go back and listen to those old great recordings, a lot of them in mono, they just sound fantastic. And his later recordings sound fantastic as well. And he wasn't a guy that was stuck in the past. He was firmly in the digital world. He made the transition whenever he could to any kind of new gear. And really someone that all engineers should look up to. So if you don't know about Rudy Van Gelder, look him up. Listen to some of the stuff he's done, because he was one of the giants in our business. My guest today is Russ Hughes, who had a successful career in multiple aspects of the music business, but started a small blog dedicated to helping Pro Tools users. That blog has grown into a group of sites that cover a variety of digital audio workstations that may be the most influential in the audio world today. Those sites include ProToolsExpert.com, StudioOneExpert.com, LogicProExpert.com, and AbletonLiveExpert.com. I spoke with Russ via Skype from his office in the UK. Tell me where the idea for Pro Tools Expert came from.
It came about as an accident, as all good ideas do. My wife came to me in 2008 and said, "Hey, I'd like to do a postgraduate course in politics, and I'm going to still do my full-time job. So every night of the week, I'm going to be studying, and every weekend, I'm going to be studying. So you've got to find something to do with your time for the next year." So then about a week or so later, it really was all like this. I was in the DUC, the Avid DUC, and it was about the time that Avid had acquired Wizoo and become Air Virtual Instruments. And people were going, "Oh, somebody should do something about that. There's no support for these air instruments." And in my experience, my dad sort of always taught me that when people say somebody, they mean anybody but themselves. And I thought, well, I've got a year on my hands. I've got nothing better to do with my time. And if nobody else is up for the job, then I'll do it. And I had no idea what I was doing. And I thought, I had no idea about coding web. So I thought, I'll use a blog. So I used Blogger. And I thought, I'll make a few videos, give away a few sounds that I've created over the years when I was using other samplers and stuff, so I could get some samples for use in Structure, and make a few videos, and we'll see what happens. And the rest, as they say, is history. It went, I thought, you know, Bobby, I was nobody. Nobody really knew me in the DUC. I had a few opinions, like what, as everybody does in forums, but I wasn't known to Avid, and I wasn't known to the Pro Tools community in that way. I was just the only guy who was stupid enough to take the job. And so I thought, you know what, 20, 30 people a week would watch my videos. And before I knew it, thousands were watching them, and then tens of thousands, and it all went a bit silly.
Wow. What was the run-up then? So how long did it take before it dawned on you that, wait, this is maybe a serious career path?
Yeah, well, it didn't really... it's hard sometimes for people to really believe you when you say you're doing something for altruistic aims, but it really was... At the outset, me just thinking, you know what? I'd been in studios and production for 20 years previous to that. I'd been around some really great people who'd shown me the way and kind of shown me cool tips and tricks, like you, Bobby. And I thought, if I could just give some of that back to people, and because of the internet, they don't have to sit in my studio with me, they can watch me online, then that's a really cool way of doing it. So I just did that for about 2 years. And you know what? I thought, I'm going to reach out to some people who I knew in the industry, and I'm not going to name names, but I knew editors of top magazines and people from way back, and said, "Would you just mind running a story about my blog?" And nobody would even reply to me. Nobody wanted to know. I think then, about a year in, David Gould, who's now at Dolby, called me one day, or he emailed me, he said, "Hello, my name's David Gould. I work for Avid, and at the time, DigiDesign." And he said, "I've been seeing what you're doing with your blog. Can we have a chat with you?" And so I went to Pinewood, which is the UK headquarters of Avid, and I met him and two of his other colleagues, and they said, "We love what you're doing. What can we do to help you?" And then I think that's when I got an inkling that there was some kind of traction happening and some kind of interest. But talking about it, kind of making a living out of it and monetization, it took then probably another 2 years again. Probably we're in year nine now. It probably took till year five before it was anything that you could call making money out of it and supporting any kind of income with it. So it took me 5 years to become an overnight success.
But really, isn't that the kind of like the normal thing in the music business? No matter which way you look at it, there is no overnight success. It does take a while to do anything, but it just seems like it snowballs at the end. All of a sudden, everybody hears about you, so then it becomes the overnight success. But the run-up is, it always takes time, no matter what you're doing in the business, it seems.
Yeah, I think you're dead right. I think nobody knows whether it's a band who've played gigs to three people or a producer that's been producing like the local bands for 25 years and then he gets his break, or the engineer that was making tea for 10 years and then one day the producer in the studio is off with laryngitis or something and he's got to step into the session with the Rolling Stones in the studio that day. But I think nobody, it's so easy for us to forget, isn't it, that people have often done a lot of legwork before they're ever in any kind of public eye.
I just had Ed Cherney, the famous engineer on the podcast, and I've known him for a long time and I've used him in the studio. And we got to talking and he said, you know, I was a journeyman for 15 years before I broke out. Which, you know, again, that's the same thing. All of a sudden, he breaks out and he has Record of the Year. He has, you know, all sorts of Grammys and he's working with the Rolling Stones and you know, who's who. But he said he was a journeyman taking whatever gig he could in the meantime, which, again, there's your perfect situation. It goes a little longer than we like, but it's the perfect example of kind of the way it goes in the business, I think.
It is, and it's interesting. I wrote an article recently for LinkedIn, and it was because I'd been really troubled seeing... I went to a website of a guy who had written to me 2 years ago and said, I see what you do on the blog, and I'm going to do it because you've inspired me. And I've always been encouraged by that. I don't feel threatened by that at all. If there's 1,000 Pro Tools experts out there doing their thing, and it's probably like you, Bobby, we're both cut from the same cloth, go for it. So this guy said to me, hey, I'm going to start a blog. It's all about drum virtual instruments. And I thought that's a really unique angle to take. Go for it. And he did it. And then I went, I stumbled upon his Facebook group, which grew to 6,000 fans in about 6 months.
Wow.
It took me 5 years to do that, Pro Tools Expert.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this guy's got some traction. And I went to his Facebook wall the other day, and he hadn't posted something since May this year. And it had all died out. And it inspired me to write an article that was why 99% of blogs fail. And the truth is, you just have to keep doing it. You have to get up, come rain or shine, come sickness, come health, come broke, come rich, whatever you are. And I know there are people on the team, because I don't actually day-to-day now run the blogs anymore. I've got Mike and his team over at Pro Tools Expert doing it. I know there have been days when they've lost friends or they've got family in hospital and they've still posted a blog post because they're so committed to supporting the community. And I think that's the truth of it, isn't it, Bobby? Whether it's Ed with his studio, you with your work or whatever we're doing, that it's about getting up every day and whatever you feel like, you know, there are an audience out there that depend on you, that get up and think, I want to read Bobby's blog today. And so they're expecting to see something from you. And they don't know what's happening in your life, but you just keep putting it on. So that's why most blogs fail, because they stop doing it.
Well, I know for me, that's the first thing I do every day in the morning. It's the first hour to 2 hours of my life, putting the blogs together. And I don't do it for that day, I do it for the following day. But if I'm going on vacation, I schedule everything and I work double the time. So when I go on vacation, it comes out on time and nobody knows the difference. But, I don't look at it as a burden. It's not a burden. No. It's something that I'm doing. It's fun. I like it. I enjoy the feedback. But if you look at it as work, if you feel it's work, I think, you know, that's the problem for a lot of people, because it is work. It's something that you have to think about. As you well know, Russ, you've gone through this a lot, I'm sure, as well, where, you know, some days you think, what am I going to write today?
Yeah. Then something happens, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Then something happens. And so I've got, here's a sneak peek. I don't know when this is going out, but we just did a poll recently about, we put three tuning software applications up against one another and asked people to choose which one they preferred. The vocal, we left in the original vocal as well, so they could choose of the four, the original vocal or the three tuned versions. And only about 10% chose the original. And I kind of felt a bit sad about that because it's a girl I know and it wasn't a bad vocal. It was got a bit of pitchiness now and again, but it was kind of stylistically pitchy. And so later on this week, I've written an article because then it inspired me to write a new article, which is that perfection is overrated. And if you listen to some of the best albums out there, and some of the best tracks, like Every Breath You Take, the tempo's all over the place.
Yeah.
There's wow and flutter on it. Sting's vocal, I know somebody who put Sting's vocal from that track, from the multi-track, into a tuner, and it's all over the place. But it is a perfect pop song.
Yeah.
And if anybody tells me it's not, I'll rip them a new ass. But perfection is not what it's about.
Yeah, I know.
So that's where I get inspired. You probably see stuff happening on the blogs and you think, oh, that's a good idea for an article.
Oh, all the time. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I keep a list of things, as I'm sure you do, where I can always refer back. And a lot of times someone will do something and I'll go, oh, I wish I would have thought of that. You know, that happens a lot too. Just like you're talking about your tuning, where it's like I'm sitting here thinking, wow, that's a good idea. I wish I would have done that. But, you know, it's.
Well, I remember we shot The Breeze, didn't we? Do you remember at NAMM last year? We were shooting The Breeze with Cliff Marg and we were having dinner and the stories you guys were sharing. And I thought, Bobby's got about a year's worth of blogging out of this meal alone because there's some great stories. Like, do you remember they mentioned that you've probably forgotten this from that meal, but what his co-director from Marg Audio said that when they swapped to Electrets or Dynamics or something at the Morbin Tabernacle Choir, they put all their vintage Neumanns in a cupboard and they're all in storage.
Yeah.
These vintage Neumanns. And I thought, what a great story.
Well, I've had Cliff on the podcast as well as a result of that. And it's great. And it's funny because I expected him to actually recount some of the same stories and he didn't. And there was one in particular that I had to drag out of him. And that's how he came up with the ZQ, with the airband and everything, trying to emulate the sound of a 251, which I think is, that's so important to the story of that EQ.
Yeah.
And it's something that he kind of overlooks, I think, sometimes. But that, and it's very true. If you put that EQ on certain tracks, you're going to pull that sound out. It's not going to be exactly the same, but you pull it out. So again, yeah, you're right. Just, you know, sitting there with him the whole time, I'm thinking, yeah. Okay, I know where I'm going with this with him if I can get him on the show. So, and well, but it's the same with you because again, you have a rich history. And let's go back and talk about that for a second. So before Pro Tools Expert, what were you doing?
Well, where it all started was that I was working in a music store in the early 80s when MIDI arrived and sampling arrived. And it was a music store called Jones and Crossland, which was in the second biggest city in the UK called Birmingham. And just down the road, we had studios. We had some big bands from Birmingham like UB40 and Sabbath and all these kind of... Zeppelin were just out, all those kind of bands had been born out. So it was quite a rich musical heritage. And just up the road as well, we had two big concert venues. And very quickly, I'm one of these people that can work things out without manuals, although I do devour manuals. So around that period when it all kind of hit, I sort of kind of understood MIDI early on and understood the whole of the music technology thing as it kicked off. And some bands started to come to me and say, hey, we've just been in the studio with this top producer. We haven't got a clue how he made our sounds with these synths or a clue how this sequencer works. Can you do it? And so I became basically, do you remember programmers? I was a programmer in the early days.
Yeah.
And I was working for loads and loads of top bands, programming for them, often to get their live shows out on the road to take their... I'd have to sit down with the album... And often the producer wouldn't tell you. I'd have to sit down with the album and translate what had happened into the studio for live. This was before any kind of Pro Tools rigs and stuff. It was just ropey sequencers and stuff. And I'd have to get synths like the DX7. So I was an early DX7 programmer. So I understood operator synthesis really on. So they'd come with DX7s and say, I need to get this sound we used in the studio. I don't know how he did it, or the Jupiters and stuff. And so I would basically build an album for a band for them to take out on the road. And it just became busier and busier. And I did that for quite a long time in the whole advent of MIDI and sampling. I remember when the first sound designers came along, when it was just two channels and it was £25,000 with a Mac.
Yeah.
So that was where I got into it. And then I was also a musician myself. Obviously, that's why I was working in a music store. And so I started doing some writing myself and some producing myself. And I worked actually in the gospel music industry for quite a long time, writing for that. And so it became quite well known in that small world. And so I would hang around with some really great talent. And it was really exciting. And that was, 30 years ago now. So the whole of the 80s, I was doing that kind of stuff. And then into the 90s, I walked into studios more and played more and wrote more. So I did a lot of publishing. And that was fun.
You just mentioned gospel music. I didn't realize gospel was that big in the UK.
It's nowhere near as big as the US, because the US, it's kind of culturally part of the whole musical makeup. But the whole kind of Christian music scene in the UK, it's a niche, but it still has a noticeable size. And during the whole last 20 years or so, there's things like the Hillsong movement happened, which is mammoth. They're out of Australia. And the Vineyard movement, which came out of California, and all those kind of gospel brands, should I say, I'll be shot for saying that, but that's the best way of saying it. They have grown into sizable chunks of business now. The big market still is the USA, but there's big markets out there as well, across in Australia and Europe and the UK. And so it's quite a sizable chunk, but nothing, as you say, like America.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, when I think of gospel music, it's different than Christian music. You're talking more Christian than gospel, right?
Yeah, middle-of-the-road Christian music, kind of like, yeah.
Yeah,
people like Steve Curtis Chapman and people like that.
Got it.
Those kind of guys. And a lot of that runs out of Nashville in America, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. That seems to be the hub of all that.
And that's right.
There are studios that are big, huge facilities.
Yeah.
That's all they do there, which
exactly.
is very interesting to me.
Sparrow is the big brand.
Sparrow, yeah. And not only that, the music is great. The artists are great. Everything is dynamite about it. It's just that they have, and unfortunately, they're not widely known because it's not secular enough. Although there's been some crossovers, but you look at it and you think, wow, there's some great artists here.
A lot of stuff has been born out of that. So if you think of somebody like Vance Powell, he started off mixing for the Jars of Clay.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
who are a gospel band, a Christian music band. And then obviously Vance has got his own, won a Grammy this year for his work with Chris.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people that find themselves in that industry for a period of their lives, and it can be quite fruitful. But as I say, it's gospel, I suppose, in American terms, is kind of the black gospel music, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah, when you say gospel, that's kind of what you think about. That's why when you mentioned gospel, I thought, wow, I didn't realize that there was that kind of culture there in the UK. And I've been in the UK a lot, so I figured I would have been exposed to it at some point. But
it's been such a small market. It's all kind of combined together almost. You can't make it as narrow. So you'll find that the black artists are working with white artists and often on the same platforms and gigs.
As it should be. As it should be.
It should be.
Let's get back to Pro Tools Expert for a second. So eventually you then expanded into other workstations. I'm wondering what was behind that. Was it because there was a market niche that you spotted? Was there a number of people that said to you, I'm getting a lot out of Pro Tools Expert. I wish there was something more specific to what I'm doing? Because honestly, in my 101 mixing tricks, I've found that where I try to make it as agnostic as possible. And much of what you have in Pro Tools Expert is agnostic as well. There's some, very pointed articles and videos, but a lot of it's very agnostic. But still, there are some people that just can't make the transition from one DAW to another.
Well, it's actually interesting. I was told to do it. What would happen is that we would probably get an email a week when we were just Pro Tools saying, when are you going to do one for Cubase? When are you going to do one for Studio One? When are you going to do one for Logic? And I always resisted it for the simple reason is that Pro Tools Expert was born organically. It wasn't contrived. It wasn't, let's build a brand. And it wasn't, let's go and find all the Pro Tools users and make money out of them. It was not born out of that, as you know from the start of this story. It was born out of somebody who used the software who wanted to help the community. So I really thought that the only way this can work is not that if I do it, but if we can find other people to do it for us. So if we can find somebody who's as passionate about logic with the same kind of, who can build the same kind of community and have those skill sets, then that's possible. But I kept pushing it to the back of my mind. Then I was in London and Pete Gorges from Wizoo, UJam, the guy that invented lots of great virtual instruments, he's now making virtual guitarists. He's a friend of mine. And he took me out for a coffee and he said, Russ, I need to talk to you. You should do all of these. You can do this. And he kind of pointed at me and was really quite tough about it and said, Russ, you could do this. I said, well, Pete. So I went home that night and registered all the domains with no idea of how we were going to do it. And then I first found a guy called Dennis who was running Dansky's Logic blog. And I reached out to him and said, listen, I've been asked to do a Logic one. Would you be interested in doing it and calling it Logic Pro Expert and going for it? And he went, yes. Yeah. So we tried it. And that just took off really quickly. The great thing about doing all the hard work in the early days, it's a bit like being a management company that signed a great band, isn't it? That once you've got one under your belt, it's a lot easier to get the second one out normally because yeah. You've got some reputation and you've got some credibility. And that's how it's always been done. So each time we have felt that we should try and do another one, we've gone and found somebody. So like Martin Delaney, who runs Ableton Live Expert, is a passionate Ableton trainer. He's really good at what he does. He's got a lot of respect in the community. So he runs that. And they're all independently run by these guys. We kind of give them the infrastructure and the backbone. And then we say, right, over to you now. You're going to write the articles. We're going to find ways of get advertisers so that you can give this away for free, this stuff. But otherwise, it's over to you. So Studio One Expert, for example, that has done in a year in terms of readership and growth what it took 5 years to get Pro Tools Expert to.
Wow.
And I think that's a combination of, one, the popularity of Studio One Expert that's coming through and the enormous love that pre-sonars have. I really didn't think that was going to happen because pre-sonars do such a great job anyway. And secondly, it's down to a great team who are just working really hard. But I think thirdly, it's down to the Expert brand has some kind of equity in it now.
Yeah.
And so that's how it works. It has to be organic, Bobby. It can't be me thinking, oh, let's make a few quid out the Expert brand by sticking it onto some other brand, other DAW or other product now. It has to be that somebody comes and we see a need and then we find the people who are right to address that need.
Well, it all comes down to that. If you have the right people that are passionate about it, then that's the whole game right there. Because if you have someone that's doing it just as a gig, it's not the same as somebody who's really, really into it and lives and breathes it every day.
I think the first thing, I tell you, it's the worst advertising for a job ever. Because when we go to a person who we think is going to be the editor of a new site, we say, do you want to work really hard for a year for no money? Because that's the opening gambit for the Expert sites. You don't do it for money. You certainly don't do it in the first year for anything other than you're passionate about serving a community. Because the first year, you just have to put your hours in to try and build a community that we can later on try and create some income to support the people that are running that site without having to charge the users who are reading it.
Yeah. So, but again, you tell them up front.
Yeah, we don't say, do you want to be a millionaire? Because I'm not a millionaire. Nobody's a millionaire doing this. Yeah. So that's how it was born, and that's the whole philosophy of it.
What do you see as the most popular DAW right now?
It's hard to say. I always address we've been doing a myth series recently on Pro Tools Expert, which is the best door myth. And so let's deal with that one first. In my mind and in the mind of all the teams that are on the blogs, the best door is the one that suits you. I think that's the reality. They're so close, Bobby, aren't they? They jump each other. Like one does something, then someone else does something. And then as you see them evolving, somebody will get ahead with like tuning or somebody will get ahead with timing and some of the great features. So in terms of the best door, I don't buy into that argument. I think it's a pointless one. In terms of popularity, from our experience as the Expert sites, Studio One is powering ahead. I think it's gaining a lot of traction from our own numbers and from what we're seeing. It's the one to watch right now. In terms of a music-making application, It can't touch Pro Tools for post. But in terms of a good solid music application, it actually reminds me of the early days of C-Lab when they did Notator and Creator in the early 80s. It has that kind of feel about it, that kind of originality about it, that kind of excitement about it. You're talking about numbers of seats out there. I still think that Pro Tools owns it. We have to face that. That's a fact. It's still the most ubiquitous platform in pro studios and in post houses around the world.
Yeah.
A simple fact. And I don't think that will go anywhere soon. That would be my own personal view on that.
It's funny because I talk to a number of people that come from large post facilities. And I live in Burbank, so I'm you know, right in the middle of television and movie post. And you talk to some of these people and they'll say, you know, every single decision that we have is so wide ranging because we have 250 workstations. You know, we have 150. And these numbers that they throw out of Pro Tools stations that they have, you know, it'll boggle your mind. But that being the case, it's true. Every time there's a new upgrade, they have to really take stock on whether it's worth it, because if they have to change something, it's going to cost them a lot of money across all of them. And it's something that the average user doesn't run into at all, but yet the post community does, and it's something that they're very cognizant of. One of the things that it looks like it's happening, though, is, do you feel this, and this is what I'm getting from people, tell me if you feel the same, do you feel that Avid is kind of looking down market now instead of at those major users?
I think that not necessarily down market. I do think I've recognized, I don't know how you feel, but a real change in tone from Avid for the better in probably the last 6 months in terms of the conversations we've been having with them, in terms of their marketing outreach, in terms of their offering, and if you think about what they've been bundling with Pro Tools, they suddenly got, you know, what people do want, extra stuff. So a lot of stuff that used to be behind the paywall is now free, used to only get with HD. But more than that, I think that I'm seeing less of the Avid Everywhere message that we had real concern about on Pro Tools Expert, and it didn't endear us to Avid because we truly didn't believe it. And if we truly don't believe it, and one of the reasons that Pro Tools Expert has earned the reputation it has is we've always tried to be as honest as possible, whatever that's cost us. It has cost us dearly sometimes in terms of advertising revenue. We've had accounts cancelled on us worth $20,000 because we won't say something nice about something. But I think I need to be able to sleep at night. And I think that's how, and users aren't stupid either. They know if you're you know what I mean? You can't fool people. You can for a short period. But I really do believe that the tone of the message seems to be probably more inclusive rather than down market. That would be the word I'd use. Mm. I think there's a sense of trying to, that grandiose visions, in some ways, I think Avid Everywhere was one of those conversations they should have had in the building, not outside the building.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Say, this is what we're trying to achieve. A bit like Apple and the whole i environment, is that the iTunes thing is an ecosystem. And Avid Everywhere, at its simplest form, is an ecosystem they're trying to create. They're trying to be the next Adobe. I get that. But I don't know how wise it was to put out these grand ideas and these grand plans to generally most people who don't really give a rat's ass about it. They just want to go out and either go into a post house and make movies all day with software that works, or make great tracks with software that doesn't crash. And so whilst you've got these grandiose plans being talked about from large platforms at Las Vegas, the average person was going, this doesn't really connect with me. It's a bit like the big problem we've had in the UK with the whole Brexit vote, and I don't want to go political here, but what people didn't account for when they were using the message of fear about we're going to all be more broke was, to the average person in Britain, they felt broke anyway, so it was no different. And what I'm trying to, the comparison I'm trying to draw here in that illustration is that the average person looking at those kind of things from Las Vegas shows and stuff, it just doesn't translate. And I think that I feel that Avid might have, that the penny might have dropped there. And in the last 6 months, it does feel a much more inclusive, much more grounded message. I don't know how you feel.
Well, it's good to hear, because there's another podcast I do, Audio Nowcast, and there's some people that there that have been very plugged into Avid for a long time. Avid execs, they were beta testers. They knew people within Avid that they could talk to if they had a problem. And that has all gone away. Where now you sit with these people and go, I don't know who's over there. All the people I knew are gone. I don't know who to talk to if I have a problem. So that seems to be very pervasive these days. It's hard to find a friend over there, a friend at Avid, and someone that you could talk to. Now, you're kind of on a different level because you should be dealing with them on a different level. But it's good to hear, in fact, that things are looking more positive, because from our side, it doesn't seem that way. There's a lot of question marks still. So I feel good when I hear what you're talking about.
Let me put it this way, though. I'm not saying everything's perfect at Avid. I still think they have a lot of work to do. They have a lot of work to do with building trust again.
Yeah.
Trust on a technical and on a social and on a personable level, because of what you've just said. In fact, most of the people I knew at Avid when I started the blog are gone. I've outlived virtually every member of staff at Avid since running the blog.
Yeah.
I've outlived at least one CEO. I've outlived more execs at the top table than I can count on two hands. I've outlived most of the staff. In fact, there's probably five people left at Avid now that were there when I started running the blog 9 years ago. And that's partly par for the course with a corporation. I said to them, I was sat down by the then CEO, Gary Greenfield, if you remember Gary.
Yeah.
And he said, what do you think is the issue facing Avid? I said, the biggest issue facing Avid is you're a corporate and the most of the people that got into this industry got to stick it to the man. We don't do corporate. So you've got to find a way of translating your whole corporate thing on a level which builds trust and is a dialogue that makes sense to the average person using your software. Most of the people using your software don't go out and play golf on a Sunday. Most of the people using your software don't dine at Michelin star restaurants. They're sat behind a mixing console with a burger in their hand. So that disconnect has to somehow be matched. And I think that's been their biggest issue for as long as they've been listed. I remember you writing an article that said that's the peril of being a listed company in this industry. It's almost a mismatch. And I think it's true. I think you're going to love one and hate the other. And I mean that I'm using a kind of almost Bible phrase there. But when you've got two masters, one is the stockholders and one is the users, I'm not sure how easy it is to keep both of them happy. So you have to choose one. And I'm guessing most of the time it's the people that are buying the stock.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sad but true. Do you think that there's a possibility of Pro Tools being spun off?
If you want my honest opinion, I think it's been for sale for at least 3 years.
Really?
I think that's been going on behind the scenes for a long time. I think that if you talk to them officially, and I've had quite a lot of off the records, nobody has ever said to me that that is the case. But I think you have to look at Avid's performance in terms of financial market performance and their performance as a brand that looks like it's shrinking rather than growing in our marketplace. And you have to then say, well, only it's got to be one option on the table. That that's the crown jewels of the brand, and it can be monetized. So I do think that if the right person came, and I've heard names put around the industry, I could tell you names that I don't think are ever going to do it. Are people like Universal Audio? I think that's a conversation that I couldn't imagine ever happening. And all sorts of brands like that. So I do think for at least 3 years, it's been something that they would entertain. But that's not official. That's just my conjecture.
So you mentioned Universal Audio. I always thought that they'd be next up to do their own DAW.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Well, it nearly is a DAW, isn't it? The mixer's there. The only thing they need is now is the recorder.
Yeah.
Waves the same.
Yeah.
Waves have got DigiGrid. They've got the recording based on the ARDA platform with their tracks. That Tracks Pro, it's only a matter of time. But looking back to what you said earlier, when you've got 250 seats in a post house with a lot of staff that would need training, the CapEx, the investment you've made, the inertia against changing is huge. Better the devil you know, a lot of these people would think. If it works, why change it? And for a lot of these big moneyed post houses, TV stations and top studios, I think it's to get, when you've got something as ubiquitous as Pro Tools, that's a cultural norm in our industry. So to change to something else is not a product shift, it's a culture shift. That's my belief of this. Pro Tools is ubiquitous, and to change that overnight, I reckon it would take, if Avid stopped today, it would take 5 years minimum for everything to shift to a new place. That would be my view of it.
I think you're right, Russ. And I just had a dialogue editor on the show who works on a bunch of big network television shows. And he was telling me that he went through a number of DAWs and over a 10-year period where the industry was looking for something and couldn't standardize. And it took a long time until Pro Tools became that ubiquitous choice that everybody had to have. And now, you know, there's a trend. You talk about the 250 stations and everything, but there's a trend in Hollywood of getting people off the lot, getting people out of the building, keeping them at home on their own systems. And, you know, again, what we have is the home studio, only it's the home post studio now to some degree. So it'll be interesting to see if that changes anything, because at that point, it's like, well, who cares what you use as long as you get the job done to some degree.
Well, that's it. That's interesting. Let's take my, I was thinking about this the other day. I'd never really thought about it because we run a news blog about Avid and Pro Tools amongst other DAWs. And because we're writing content daily, you sometimes forget this thing, which is that the platform we write the blog on, it's called Squarespace. There are other ones out there. There's WordPress, there's Blogger. There's probably about 40 reasonable ones you could try. Yet for us, it's just a tool. So it works. It's the right one for us. We made a decision and we're sticking with it. And I actually went on the Squarespace blog last night, which tells you about all the new product features that are in Squarespace. I hadn't read it since May this year, so I didn't even know these things existed. And yet I'm happily blogging every day. And I think the reality is with a lot of professionals using Pro Tools, it's the same for them. It works. It does what it does. It might have 10 new features in Pro Tools 12. There may be 30 other doors out there that could do it better. But as far as they're concerned, it's the tool they use. Do you know what I mean? So it's, I don't think they always see Pro Tools like us journalists do. And I use journalists in the loosest sense of the word, because as bloggers do, should I say. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. I know what you're saying. And hey, it's the same for everybody. You're comfortable with what you're using and you change only because you're forced to. I started with Digital Performer version 1. And of course it was MIDI, and then there was some audio built into it. And then I moved to Nuendo version 1. And I loved Nuendo, but it got to the point where all the projects I was getting were Pro Tools. I had to change because it was such a pain to convert the Pro Tools over to Nuendo and then back again for delivery, that it was like, okay, I'm just going to give in. So at that point, it was the industry pressure that was telling me to do something that I didn't really want to do. Happily, it worked out. So I'm not complaining. But, you know, there are points in time where you look at it and you go, well, hey, it doesn't matter what you're using as long as you're getting the job done and no one's complaining.
I will caveat that, though, Bobby, which is there's a point when the pain takes over from the inertia. And I was getting so tired of the pain points I was having in Pro Tools when I was writing, because I'm a composer first of all, that I started using Studio One. And if you might have seen, I wrote that article, Why is a Studio One user now using... the article was entitled, Why is a Pro Tools evangelist now using Studio One? I felt I had to write that article to explain myself a little so people didn't feel somehow cheated by me. And it was because the inertia of learning a new DAW was taken over by the pain of using Pro Tools for writing and composing it. Still a great recording platform, still a great mixing platform, but when it came to composing with instruments and stuff, it was just a pain in the ass for me. Yep. So I started using Studio One, and that's the one I switch on now when I'm going to compose stuff, because it works. And there is that tipping point, I think, in everyone's life where they go, if this thing crashes one more time, I'm going to go, I'm doing something about it.
Yeah.
And so inertia only lasts for so long.
Yeah, you're right. Do you see another DAW coming up besides, I know you said Studio One is the hot one right now, and you see a lot of inertia in that, but is there something else that you see that's kind of bubbling under?
It's interesting. I'm we did a survey last year, and people use between 2 and 3 DAWs all the time now, each person. So I use Studio One and Pro Tools. And Ableton always comes high on a discussion. So because of its live features and things like that. Do you know what? I don't want to see another DAW. I think there are too many out there already. I can't think of anybody that could make a DAW that would be so original that something it isn't already doing, or using two DAWs can't do. So I don't really look for the possibility of another DAW. Kind of bores me, to be honest. I just want the ones that make them already to carry on going for it, and carry on listening, and carry on. When you've been making a DAW like Pro Tools for 20 years, there's two problems. One, you've got a big market that you can kind of take advantage of in the best sense of the word and the worst sense of the word. And secondly, you've got such a code base. And I wrote this the other day with somebody who was talking to me. They say, why doesn't Avid do this quick? I said, because you can't do it quick. You've got Pro Tools has 4 versions, really. It has a HD version, and it has a native version. Then it has music customers, and it has post customers. So every time Avid have to make a change in Pro Tools, and it has to be backward compatible. So for Avid to do anything quick is impossible. If you want somebody that's going to be moving things quick in the DAW world, don't buy into Pro Tools, because it's rocks. Because it's that legacy is both a blessing and a curse for Avid, because the code base is 25 years longer. They've got to keep servicing the heritage of this DAW. So I just think that people should work really hard on innovating the ones that are already out there. I don't want to see another DAW. I think it would bore me stupid. What about you?
Well, I'm not moving from Pro Tools until I absolutely have to at this point. I'm very comfortable with it. So, but, you know, I do agree with you. There are everything else, virtually everything else is easier to create on. And I look at Logic and I go, yeah, better. You know, if you're going to create, better. And I look at Studio One, yeah, if you're going to create, better. But, You know, again, when it comes down to pro stuff, that if I have to edit, you know, I definitely want to do it on Pro Tools. I have 2 more questions for you, Russ, and then I'll let you go. And you've been very kind to spend this time with me. I appreciate it. The first one is, I see a lot coming from Sociotech. So what is that? Where did that come from?
It's good. I'm glad this came up, because this is an important part of the discussion. So when the blog really started to take off, I had brands coming to me and saying, I see what you've done with Pro Tools Expert. So, and you've managed to harness a whole community around Pro Tools. How did you do that? And I kept having this conversation. I'd have all sorts of companies coming to me and saying, will you do it for us? And I said, well, I can't do it for you. I'm running a blog. And so 5 years ago, I decided to stop my job. I was at that point, I was running post houses later in my career. So I've done a stint in post production as well in the audio and film world. And I started this small advisory company that helps brands in our sector, companies, especially small companies, to communicate better with their users. And at that point, there was another issue that was affecting me, which was, hang on, I can't really do that and write a blog with all good conscience, because there's kind of a conflict of interest if I'm not careful. So that's when I drew back from the blogs, and Mike is now running Pro Tools Expert. And so I've got editors that run the site that make the editorial decisions, and people writing. And I've got, and if a brand I work for makes a product, I can't review it. It would be somewhat odd if I was reviewing a product I want them to get out there.
Yeah.
And so I'm now spending my days. Yes, I now and again, they let me loose on the blog to write an opinion piece if I want to have an opinion on something. But generally, I'm running Sociotech full-time now with a couple of team. And we work with brands like Sound Radix and Michael at Exponential Audio and Townsend Mics.
Yeah.
Townsend Labs, who've just launched the Sphere mic. And Synchro Arts. There's about 10 small brands. And they, it's interesting because they're all small companies with people who are passionate and smart and making some of the cleverest products out there right now, like Auto Align, for example, or Michael Kahn's making these fantastic native reverbs that use tiny processing power, but people absolutely adore. And they're on virtually most albums out there now. You can hear them creating Galaxies Far, Far Away. That's as much as I can say without breaking any kind of stuff and all sorts of things like that. So I'm really thrilled to be able to work with some of the nicest, smartest people in the industry who are making great products and helping them to communicate and using the stuff that I learned from my time on the blog about community and what they expect from a company making products for them, so that they are listening to these communities and they are making products that make sense. I have one company, and for the last 3 years, I said, there's only three things we need to concentrate on. It's workflow, workflow, workflow. And they laughed. I said, because when you're using this stuff, you've got time to read the manual or figure it out. You just want to get on with it and align a vocal or align some drums or connect with a guy in the other side of the world, because I work with Source Elements, the people who do over the internet recording. So that's what Sociotech is. It's an agency that I advise these companies on product development. So I'm often, let's say Townsend Labs, I've been around with those guys for 2.5 years as they've been developing this mic in secret and going back and forth. And that's been fun.
It looks very interesting. I got to say, I just ran something this morning on my blog on New Music Gear Monday, and I featured the L22. And it looks very interesting. I'd love to get my hands on one these days and try it myself.
Well, let me tell you what happened with that mic, because this is the cut. If you want to know what Sociotech do, so here's an example of what we do. So Chris Townsend called me 2.5 years ago, said, I'd like to chat with you, Russ, about helping me with this project. And he told me about it, and we spent 6 months talking about it. I said, what I'd like you to do at NAMM 2015, which is 18 months ago, is rent a house, turn it into a recording control room, take your mic in, and I'm going to send you some of the most negative sound engineers I know who hate new tech into that house to spend time with you and that mic, and and they're going to rip it to shreds. They're going to absolutely tell you what's wrong with it. And he did. All credit to him and Eric, who run the company, they did that. And it was the most valuable exercise we ever did, because I said, listen, unless you do that, if we're going to be expected to be taken seriously by recording engineers, we've got to make sure it's going to work when it does eventually come to market. And that's the kind of, so I give them that kind of advice, which is, I have always been told, it's a great expression, you can deal with anything as long as it's the truth. And I think there's I love that expression.
Yes, I agree. Well, that's hardcore, Russ, but it's the right thing. It's the right thing. If you're going to sell these people, then you have to know what they think and what they want.
And I did. I sent some really miserable Flat Earth Society sound engineers into that room who love their vintage mics, who own a C12 from 1975 or something, and said, listen, I want you to tell me everything you hate about this product. And that's why now, I don't know if you've seen the numbers, they had a target of hitting £40,000 on a crowdfunding thing in 30 days. It's now just crossed 100, and it's just about to hit $180,000.
Yeah, I know. That's impressive.
In 6 days. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's because that mic has been reinvented at least twice in the last 2 years.
What more can you say? That's what's supposed to happen. That's product development. That's the real deal. So good for them for wanting to go that far, because a lot of times you don't get that. Last question, Russ. In your time, just in the music business in general, what is the biggest lesson or piece of advice that you've learned along the way in music, in music business, in anything? Was there someone that imparted a piece of advice that really hit home for you?
It's interesting. I've interviewed people and asked this question loads of times. I thought it must be easy to answer, but now you've put me on the spot. I'm just thinking for a moment. And actually, this has kind of crystallized in the last few weeks, but it's probably this: you can't rush quality. And it's almost going back to what we just said about the mic, is you can't fake quality. You can't fake a great vocal. Even if the tools are out there now to do things that weren't thought possible of even 20 years ago, you can't fake a great drum performance. It takes skill and talent, both in the artist or the writer of a great song, or the engineer or the producer. And in our kind of instant music making society that we have now, we're kind of presenting a story to the new generation of engineers that anything is possible. You can fix it in the mix. I don't believe that. I think that real quality shows, and even more than that, stands the test of time. So if you're going to get into this, if you want to make a career out of making music, whether that's on one side of the glass or the other, spend time crafting your skills and crafting the things that you put out, because you're never wasting your time if you do that. You're wasting your time if you try and take shortcuts, because it will be like a burger from a fast food chain versus a beautiful meal that you'll never forget again. That would be my thing, that I've sometimes tried to take shortcuts and I regret it now. And I think the things that really matter are the things that I took time over and I didn't settle. So I think if it's in one line, don't settle.
If you're not familiar with the production expert sites, then you really should be. Check out ProToolsExpert.com. That's Pro-Tools-Expert.com, Studio1Expert.com, LogicProExpert.com, and AbletonLiveExpert.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.